With a warming climate, Maine has been experiencing a shift in the growing season, including a trend towards a longer season. Variability in weather, from unpredictable precipitation to an uptick in extreme weather events, makes it hard for gardeners to know what to plan for. Today on Common Ground Radio, we'll discuss cultivating resilience in the face of increased weather variability. I'm Holly Cederholm, your host for a conversation about local food and organic agriculture brought to you by the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association. I'm joined by Rebecca Long, the coordinator of horticulture training programs for the University of Maine Cooperative Extension. She collaborates with experts from the University of Maine and beyond to create educational programs for gardeners and the horticulture industry. Rebecca, welcome to Common Ground Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I'd like to start off with a brief overview of the changing climate in Maine and how it relates to gardeners.
Yeah, I think as gardeners, we're really acutely tuned in to weather and changing patterns of the season. So I'm sure it's no surprise to gardeners that the patterns are shifting. So some of the general trends we're seeing in Maine: warming temperatures, especially in winter, more precipitation, mostly in the summer, and just overall things are less predictable and we're seeing more extremes. So we've had an 80 degree day in March recently. We have had extremely dry summers like 2020, followed only 3 years later by the second wettest summer on record.
Yeah, those are big changes. Some gardeners might be familiar with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. It puts out a plant hardiness zone map. And in 2023, they actually revised the map, reflecting changes in climate and temperature trends. So I'm wondering, what do these changes say about Maine as a growing region, and how can gardeners use this tool to help them?
Yeah, growing zones are interesting. They don't actually tell us quite as much as we think they do based on how heavily they're featured on plant labels. So a growing zone is defined by the coldest temperature recorded each winter. So it's a guide, never a guarantee, but a guide to what plants are going to survive over the winter. And so in that revision, we did see the zones shift warmer in Maine, meaning, you know, reflecting that warming winter temperature I mentioned. So that does mean that new plants are probably able to survive in Maine, new crops and varieties. On the other hand, it also means that new pests can potentially overwinter, new invasives might be able to come in. So what the growing zone doesn't tell us about a growing season is how long it is, and that's also shifting. So as the winters become warmer and the summers also become warmer, we're getting more of that summer growing season, which sounds amazing as a gardener, but it's tricky because plants rely on signals for their growing cycles. So some plants rely on how much time at a cold temperature they have over the winter to signal them to break dormancy. And they also rely on it for things like bud break, you know, combinations of temperature, time, sometimes also light. So as those things shift, that can cause issues with those normal growing cycles.
It sounds like a really complex thing to track. And I'm wondering, in addition to, you know, getting a sense of how their zone might have changed, and you said the map isn't a steadfast, tried and true definer of your season, what other tools or indicators might a gardener use to help deal with this shifting season? I'm thinking about like their own record keeping practices or community resources or anything of that nature.
Yeah, you totally hit it on the head. The first thing I was going to say, which is journaling. So I tell everyone to start with a rain gauge, an outdoor thermometer, and a journal, and preferably the kind of thermometer that records like the low and the high each day. And you're going to use your rain gauge and your thermometer to start tracking your local conditions, because we can have microclimates. So like I live on the north side of a hill, so you know my snow melts last. My spring bulbs are coming up later than my neighbors. So, you know, the weather app on your phone's helpful, but it's not specific to where you are. And so once you've started tracking, you can keep track in a journal of things like your first and last frost date, some extreme weather events. And phenology, which is kind of the study of the signs of changing seasons, can be really fun to track too. So taking specific plants, when do they bloom each year, you can start to track change. And then you can use those tools to also take records as you start to change your practices in your garden and really track what's working and what's not working as you change those practices.
Yeah, I always thought about the cue when the dandelions are blooming. Mm-hmm. Potatoes, like that would be an example of like a phenological cue.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Do you know of other things that might help kind of trigger people to think about seasonal shifts?
Like phenology things. Yeah, I think like Even though they're not native lilacs, everyone thinks of, but of course, getting more familiar with our native plants too, and when they're blooming, and things like when animals are migrating and arriving. Like this winter, I was talking to someone who said her bluebirds just never left, so they never migrated away. So getting really familiar with your local flora and fauna, you start to notice.
Yeah, that's helpful. So you already talked a little bit about the different impacts related to weather variability. I was hoping you could dive a little more into what people are experiencing now and what might be expected in the future.
So I already talked about kind of the warmer winters, which means we can see these new pests and invasive species. The early warm up can also be an issue, especially when we get like those, like that 80 degree day we had in March. Things like that can trick plants into starting, their buds start to open, and then we can still have a frost, you know, our normal main frost, which can go pretty late, and you can damage buds. So that's when sometimes you'll hear we lost the entire peach crop this year or the entire apple crop. Summer warming is really hard for people. The hotter it gets, the harder it is for us to be outside working. And the plants suffer from heat stress too. So, sustained temperatures over 90, the plant growth starts to slow down. And in extreme heat, we can also see plants drop their blossoms and their fruit as a way to just try to survive. So, especially peppers, this is common. All of a sudden, people will just say, "Hey, I'm not seeing any fruit." And it's because there had been a really hot period when the plant was flowering and it just dropped a whole generation of buds. Also, cool season crops can be really tricky when things are starting to get hotter. They tend to bolt prematurely. So if you're seeing your spring broccoli bolt before it even gets a nice sized head, that could be why. Also, the overall increase in precipitation, we can see a lot more plant disease issues. Plants having wet leaves is a lot of the times when you end up with fungal diseases, but also wet roots can cause a whole host of problems. So when plants are sitting in like saturated soil for prolonged periods, we can start to get root rot, which can just affect the overall ability of the plant to take up water. And also those extreme rain events, if they're extreme enough, we can start to see soil erosion, soil compaction from that. And in really wet years like 2023, we can start to see the water table come up, and that's when you get those fully saturated soils, and that can be really hard. But what's tricky is it's so unpredictable. You wouldn't want to base all of your growing practices going forward on a year like 2023 because that was so extreme. But I still talk to a lot of gardeners who are panicking and trying to figure out if they should install drainage or raise beds. But the reality is that was a record-breaking year. So, you know, and this year, past summer, we were back to relatively more normal conditions. So overall, this just makes it really hard to plan.
What are some of the tools that gardeners can use to be more adaptable and more flexible? I'm thinking about things like mulching for moisture retention or building raised beds for improving that drainage in those wet conditions. What are techniques that you think could be good tools to have in a gardener's toolkit?
Because it's so hard to predict, we can focus on just building resilience, which is our ability to withstand change. I love to start with soil health. Increasing your organic matter and limiting soil disturbance are kind of the two places to focus. Organic matter is kind of magic because in really dry conditions, organic matter is going to help your soil retain more moisture. So it's good during a drought, but it's also great during a really wet year because the organic matter is what allows soil to kind of like stick and bind together and have good structure. And that's going to allow it to drain better and also be more resistant to erosion. So that's a great example of resilience where it's kind of helping you in all different conditions. In terms of adding that organic matter, cover crop is great. The more living roots you have and for the more of the season, that's going to help build your organic matter. And those roots are also going to help stabilize your soil, which is going to help it resist erosion. You can also use compost or organic mulch. So organic mulch could be leaves, pine needles, grass clippings from a chemical-free lawn. And the bonus, not only are you adding organic matter, but you're also protecting the soil. You're shading it, which is going to help it retain moisture. So that's also going to help you in dry years. And in terms of limiting that soil disturbance, that's to just maintain the existing structure that you have and to maintain that existing organic matter. So rototilling less. Some people go no-till, which is amazing, but that doesn't work for everybody. So just trying to focus on less rototilling and maybe focusing more on using like tarping, mulching, and maybe like a broad fork to do the bed prep and the weed control you need. And even with all that, you still may need to irrigate in a really dry year. So just being prepared, having that efficient irrigation system like drip tape on hand ahead of time, because the last thing you want is like in the middle of July to be scrambling to order all your drip tape parts and figure out how the heck you even assemble a drip system. And when you do water, you really want to promote deep root growth. So if you water really shallowly, like just a little bit at a time, you're going to encourage those roots to grow much closer to the soil surface. And then as soon as it starts to dry out, those roots are going to dry out too. So by watering more deeply, less frequently, you're encouraging deep roots, and those are going to be more resilient when you do have dry conditions.
I wanted to just ask a follow-up, if you could just quickly explain cover crops for people who might be unfamiliar with that type of crop.
Great point. So a cover crop is anything you're growing not to harvest. Cover crops can be to, you know, mix back into the soil to add organic matter. If you're incorporating a legume, that can also be to add nitrogen to your soil, because legumes have a beneficial bacteria that lives in association with their roots that actually fixes atmospheric nitrogen. So it's basically free fertilizer. So some great examples in Maine is you look for a gap in what you normally grow. So if you have a spot in your garden that your early season cool crops go in, maybe after that, you could throw in some buckwheat in the summer. And buckwheat's also a great crop to smother existing weeds. That's one that goes pretty quickly, so you could potentially even get a fall crop in. Or a lot of people do fall cover crops in Maine. So if you can get in there early enough, oats and peas, or oats, peas, and vetch are a great mix. And for later, winter rye and vetch, and that actually overwinters in Maine. So it doesn't have to grow much in the winter, but it does sit there all winter, and it has those roots that hold onto the soil all winter, and then in spring it starts to grow. The trick with cover crops is, though, have a plan for how you're gonna kill them, because I've made the mistake of planting winter rye and I get an amazing 3 foot tall hand stand in the spring, only to realize that I was hand digging all of it in. So have that plan for what you're gonna do with a cover crop, but they can be a great tool.
Winter rye is a tough one in that way. You are listening to Common Ground Radio on WERU 89.9 FM. I'm Holly Cederholm, and on today's show, I'm talking with Rebecca Long of the University of Maine Cooperative Extension about resilient gardening in the face of increased weather variability. Common Ground Radio can be heard on the second Thursday of each month at 4 p.m. on 89.9 FM and at weru.org. It is brought to you by the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association. So you mentioned some of the temperature changes throughout the season, and I'm wondering about tools for kind of dealing with that problem as it arises. Like, I'm thinking maybe more from an agricultural or a farmer perspective. I know that some growers use things like shade cloth on their hoop houses to help with extreme heat, or, you know, when it's unexpectedly cold, people might use a floating row cover to add some warmth in the field. I'm curious if you have options that might be suitable on the garden scale.
Yeah. So you mentioned shade cloth, which is a great one. And I think also a feasible option for gardeners, even if you don't have, you know, the like fancy shade cloth that farmers opt for, you could use, you know, some burlap that you suspend over something, and that's a way to just provide some shade for crops that maybe don't love a ton of heat in the middle of the summer. Also, planting between two taller crops could be a way to provide a little bit of shade for crops. And growing under cover is a great way to just have more control over the conditions. So the simplest would be some floating row cover that's going to provide you some temperature protection, especially some frost protection really early in the spring. And that's as simple as making some hoop structures. They sell pre-made ones. You can get pipe and bend some yourself. And then you get this, you know, white gauzy material, and it allows moisture and airflow to penetrate, but it just provides enough temperature protection that gives you a few degrees. Plus, it's great for keeping insects out. So as we're dealing with increasing pest pressure, that's kind of a bonus. And then you can get fancier, like low tunnels, high tunnels, all the way up to a full-fledged greenhouse. And there are gardeners that have backyard greenhouses. In addition to temperature protection, you're also getting protection from excess rain. So in those structures, you're totally controlling the input of moisture. So you can avoid that like wet leaf issue that can lead to fungal issues. The thing it doesn't help with is if it's such a wet year that you get the water table just rising up. And that's a situation where raised beds can be a great option to get those roots up out of the water table.
You also mentioned irrigation, and drip irrigation is a system of sort of tubes that deliver the water like at the point of the plant versus overhead irrigation. I'm wondering if you could just talk a little bit more about why that is a benefit and gardeners might want to invest in that type of system.
And it definitely is maybe like, it's not gardening 101. It's maybe like slightly more advanced, but I think it's worth investing in and learning about. I think traditionally people in Maine either didn't always even irrigate their gardens because we used to have more reliable rainfall, or a lot of people use overhead sprinklers. The downside to overhead sprinklers, they're definitely not as efficient. You lose a lot of the water to evaporation before it even hits the ground. And as we deal with these changing weather patterns and drought years, really efficiently using water could be really important. So drip is a more efficient way to do it because that water is going right to the roots where it's needed. And it's also not getting the leaf sweat, which again, we've talked about. And it can be simple. There are soaker hoses, so that's a good like starting point, but those don't last forever. There's not really any mechanism that controls how they distribute the water, so it can be pretty uneven. Drip tape's designed so that every spot has theoretically the same amount of water coming out of it. And there are companies that sell really good starter kits, so that's what I recommend.
In addition to implementing some of these practices, gardeners may find the need to make changes to their crop plans as part of their adaptation strategy. I'm thinking in terms of seeding dates or selecting different varieties. Can you talk about those components of a more resilient garden?
So anywhere you can build in redundancy is going to be insurance. Growing more than one variety of each crop, that's going to give you a better shot that at least one variety is going to do well every year. And that's where we get back to our journal too. You can take notes on what works really well. If you have a good standby green bean, maybe introduce another variety or two each year and just take notes, because maybe the one that worked for you for the last 30 years is not working as well in the changing conditions. Another way to do that is to build in succession planting. So succession planting is where instead of planting a crop so that it gets harvested all at once, you're setting yourself up for a continuous harvest. So you can either do this by planting on multiple dates. So you plant your first green beans 1 week, and then 2 weeks later you plant more. But you can also use varieties with different days to harvest. So when you look in a seed catalog, it'll tell you how many days to harvest. So you could pick, three different varieties of carrots with different days to harvest. And even if you plant them at the same time, that's going to help stagger that harvest. And the advantage of having these staggered is that if we do have, say, like a really hot couple days, if all of your plants aren't at the same stage of growth, hopefully at least a couple of those successions are going to do better. So it's just all building in that redundancy to get some insurance. While we're talking about seed catalogs, looking at the heat tolerance, some seed catalogs are starting to include information about specific varieties with more heat tolerance, especially for those cool season crops that don't necessarily do well with heat. And you can also look for some disease resistance. A lot of catalogs will have like specific letter codes, and they'll have a little key that'll tell you. So looking for heat tolerance and disease resistance are a couple good additional things.
Are there seeds or seed breeding work that people are working on to be more resilient to climate change? I'm thinking about when people are flipping through their seed catalog, they might be looking at like open pollinated versus hybrid seeds, and it gets more complicated from there in terms of like Grexes and gene pools. But I'm curious if you know anything about climate resilient breeding for crops.
There absolutely is. We have at one of our demonstration farms, they do a lot of crop variety trials. And so each year they'll publish their results. Some of those varieties are aimed at farmers. So for a good summary for gardeners, we have a Vegetable Varieties for Maine Garden publication that was updated just 2 years ago that talks about specific varieties good for Maine gardens. And I always recommend people start with local seed companies or locally owned nurseries because they're going to be more likely to be selling the varieties adapted to our conditions. And the other thing is, you could think about getting into seed saving. You try some things and one does particularly well for you, as long as it's something that's open pollinated and you can save the seeds, it might be worth starting to save seeds and kind of creating your own variety for your own conditions. But also considering hybrids, but purchasing hybrid varieties. Like, as much as I love a good heirloom tomato, I only have room for a couple plants, and so I can't risk growing an heirloom that may be very fussy about its conditions and a lower productivity variety. I can go get my delicious heirlooms at the farmer's market, but for myself, I usually pick a solid hybrid tomato with some disease resistance built in so that I know I'm going to get at least some tomatoes from my garden.
So in terms of crop planning and building in redundancy, I'm thinking about crops that maybe take a long time or you only kind of get one shot at. Like, so some of those succession plantings just won't work for longer day to maturity varieties or crops. One crop that I think comes to mind is garlic. And traditionally, people plant garlic at the end of the growing season. And there's seems to be ongoing conversation about, should I be planting my garlic later? How do you deal with the crops that might not be prone to planting in successions?
Yeah, it's tricky because with garlic especially, you don't want to get in too late, but if you get in too early, all of a sudden you start seeing green shoots in the fall and people start to panic. For a lot of things, I think it's just following the best growing practices to begin with. So like with your garlic, making sure it has the mulch over the winter to protect it. And we talk a lot about like right plant, right place, which is the concept of making sure that the growing conditions are suited to the plant and vice versa. So the soil moisture, the amount of sunlight it likes, because if it started off on the right conditions, it's going to be the most resilient to stress. And then from there, you can start with kind of the standard main planting dates and you can mess around from there. You can't necessarily succession plant garlic, but there's no reason that if you're patient, you couldn't plant half your cloves on one date and half your cloves on a later date and just see which works better for you. So you can start to add in some like experimentation for sure.
So you already mentioned that pest and disease pressure in Maine is changing in relation to the changing climate. So what are growers experiencing now and what might they experience in the future?
Yeah, some of the conditions we're seeing, like warmer and wetter, can definitely be conducive to making pest problems worse, like spotted wing Drosophila, which is a headache for anyone who loves blueberries and raspberries. Those conditions can favor higher populations. And, you know, I already talked about the wetter summers making leaf and also root disease issues worse. But there are things you can do. So I mentioned buying disease-resistant varieties. Looking for downy mildew and early blight resistance is going to be helpful for wet years. So looking at like hybrid tomatoes with those resistance. And then for dry summers, looking for things with powdery mildew resistance can be really important. Now the trick is you can never guess which season it's going to be. So you kind of just have to go with that every season as, you know, as your insurance. And if you're growing under cover and using drip, that's another way that you're dealing with some of that leaf wetness. But you can also mess around with things like plant spacing to increase airflow. I think people get really, really tempted to cram as many plants as possible in a really small space. And I think some of the different planting philosophies, like square foot gardening, it can be tempting to go even tighter. But personally, I like to space things out a lot for exactly that reason. So my tomato plants, I'm doing as much as 4 foot of spacing between them, which can feel really excessive, but it's worth it for the airflow and to cut down on disease. Also, where you site your garden. So if you're early enough that you're still deciding where a garden's gonna go, thinking about a spot with more airflow. So yeah, avoiding that temptation to cram. In terms of insect pests, also thinking about some companion planting. So there are plants that are great hosts for predatory insects, so like sweet alyssum is an example, and we call those banker plants because they're going to help build up the population of the predators, and that's going to control the population of the prey insects, which are a lot of our pests, so things like aphids. And you can also just think about hedgerows of native plants as just a good general tool to build up your insect population. So trying to keep things in balance and build in that like natural checks and balances. But of course, I mentioned floating row cover. You know, I don't know that any amount of predators will ever take care of flea beetles. For anything that's susceptible to flea beetles, I always put on the row cover the second the plants are in the ground, whether you've seeded it or transplanted it. And then you're only taking that row cover off to harvest or do some weed control before putting it right back down. And of course, I have to mention IPM, which is integrated pest management, and that's just a system of how we control pests and includes things like setting the plant up for success to begin with. So the right fertility, the right amount of water, picking good varieties for our area. And like starting with healthy plants, so not starting with like a really root-bound seedling and making sure we're hardening off our seedlings. So combining that with good sanitation, you know, if you had a disease issue last year, making sure you're cleaning out that plant matter. If you had diseases in your tomatoes, cleaning those tomato cages before you reuse them. And then scouting for issues so you can catch them early and knowing when to act.
You mentioned planting hedgerows, and I'm curious, what is a hedgerow and what are some of the plants that you might consider using?
Yeah, and we recently we had a discussion of what's the difference between a hedge and a hedgerow. I'm not even sure, but I consider a hedgerow kind of like a slightly wilder row of plants you're adding. It can be for privacy, it can be as a wildlife corridor, it can be to help beneficial insects, and it can be a mix of shrubs and herbaceous plants. Or I've seen on farms, they will just do a row of just flowers. So any good native plants that suit your conditions. If you have a really wet spot in your garden, this would be a great plant for what would really be like a rain garden. So it's maybe too wet for a vegetable garden, but that'd be a great place you could put in some cardinal flower or our native iris or some other native plants that would benefit our ecosystem, which also is going to suffer from these changes. So as much as we can be supporting as possible.
We've spent most of the time talking about annual gardening, but with these native plants, we're shifting a little bit into perennial gardening. So, what are some ways that people can support their perennial plants in times of erratic weather?
Our perennial gardens are going to benefit from healthy soil as well. So, thinking about organic matter for them too. Leave the leaves can be a great tool. So, using those fall leaves as natural mulch, which again is also going to benefit our native insects, which overwinter in that mulch. You can also practice chop and drop, which is instead of removing all the stems and flower heads from your plants, you can leave them through the winter, which is can provide nesting habitat for native insects in the stems and food in those seed heads for our native birds. And then in the spring, ideally once it's like 50 degrees at night or warmer and all those stem nesting insects have already hatched, then you can chop them up into maybe like 6-inch pieces. You can just take big loppers out there and chop them up and just let it fall. So you don't have to feel like you have to send it to a landfill or anything, just like in nature, let it fall around the plant, and that's going to provide some natural mulch. Also, in terms of your landscape, think about reducing lawn. Lawn is pretty intensive to upkeep, requires a lot of inputs, including water. We'll be more drought resilient the less lawn we have, and instead replacing with natives, which are going to support the ecosystem. And also, natives are well adapted to our conditions, and even as those conditions change, they're at least starting off being fairly well adapted. Some of our non-native ornamentals were already really pushing the limits of what they can tolerate, and they can require a lot more inputs in terms of water and fertilizer.
Is there anything that we didn't cover that you want to speak to?
So we've been focusing primarily on what you can do in your own garden, your own landscape, but I do want to encourage the listeners to look beyond your own garden. So think about what you could be doing in your neighborhood, your town, your city, and beyond. It can be as simple as putting up a sign that kind of gives people a clue to what you're doing, like telling them that you're starting a pollinator-friendly habitat or that you're leaving the leaves to spark a conversation with a neighbor about more weather-resilient gardening. You could organize community discussions or even advocate for policies and resources that are going to support those who are impacted, especially our farms.
Well, thank you so much for talking about climate resilient gardening with us today.
Thank you.
This has been Common Ground Radio, which airs on the second Thursday of each month at 4 p.m. on WERU Community Radio. Archives of previous episodes can be found on WERU.org as well as the WERU app. I'd like to thank Rebecca for joining me today. I'd also like to thank the show's editor, Claire Boland. Stay tuned for more great programming.